Hello, everyone, and welcome to End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Candace LePage.
Candace is back, and back on for a solo mission. I think you're intimidating the other co-hosts. You're so good.
Sure, I'll take that. Okay. I won't argue.
Excellent. End Credits is our local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here in our temporary home for the summer Thursdays at 10 a.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the... I don't know what to call it, but it's The Beguiled, and we will talk about that later in the show. In the back half, that is when we'll be doing the review for the first half, we're going to tackle some of the newest movie news this week, which includes the Bechdel test. Is it the best way to promote better female character development? Or is it stifling male creativity? Interesting question, and I think we know the answer to that. And then, there was a story this week about Disney having a problem finding Middle Eastern actors to star in their live-action Aladdin. And then they announced there were two actors hired to do the roles of Aladdin and Jasmine yesterday, or Saturday, I should say. We do record this in advance, you may know. But it was at the D23 Expo last weekend, and the studios really know the question. I'll phrase this. The question is why, do studios know why it's so important to have cultural representation in their movies? And that's going to bring us to our first story, which is a man who needs no introduction, Quentin Tarantino. There has long been some curiosity about what Quentin will do next. And it's going to be a movie about one of the worst crimes in the annals of American history, the Tate LaBianca murders in 1969, which was committed by Charles Manson and his quote-unquote family of followers. Tarantino, shall we say, has a particular style, Candace? So I think there's an obvious question here. Is that mix of styles, like, is that going to be a right mix to tackle something that's still relatively controversial?
Quentin Tarantino tackling something controversial. What a shock. Yes, I do think, I don't know, reservations. I think he could have the right style. I think essentially what he's doing is remaking Natural Born Killers,
mm-hmm.
right, which he wrote,
and
then Oliver Stone?
Yeah.
Oliver Stone directed it, and it was quite different from what Quentin Tarantino expected.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's got, I mean, his films are ultra violent. That's what people expect out of Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
Obviously, this mass murder is ultra violent. I think it's, I know you say it's kind of controversial, but I do think it's probably a good time to tell it. It's still modern enough that it's still relevant. Everybody, I mean, a lot of people still talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
There is a... current fascination with true crime again, which has been happening over the last couple of years, potentially just because of the times that we're in. But there's quite a fascination for it. So I think it's the right time for this story to be told. What is weird to me about it, because I love Quentin Tarantino. I will come out here and slightly biased. He is one of my like top five directors of all time. His films are ultra violent and they take place in shady, seedy places. They're all typically bad people.
Yeah.
But he always finds the good person or the person who's good at heart or has all the values of a good person who's somehow in this, you know, violent culture for some reason.
Mm.
And so he always has a character that he imbues with a bunch of good values. And the stories always are about that person overcoming or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how he's going to find that person in this story.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting because the rumor is that it's going to focus on Sharon Tate. So that could be the angle he's taking, which is this, you know, it's a young woman who is an actress. Her life was just starting. She was married to a famous director. She was 8 months pregnant at the time she was murdered. And if I remember correctly, the house was chosen. It was Roman Polanski's house, but the Manson family, or Manson, told the family he chose the target because it was the home of a music producer who rejected his demo.
Hmm.
And I think that's why that house was chosen. So it does, you know, the combination of just fate or, you know, bad luck or however you want to look at it, plus the kind of, I guess, the living memory of Sharon Tate, because in the mix of all this is Sharon Tate's sister, who said that unless she is brought in as a consultant of some kind, she's going to fight tooth and nail. And even though this is a Tarantino movie, so it's being kept like strictly under wraps. Mm-hmm. So no one really knows what it's about. There's bits of casting assumptions, Margot Robbie and Jennifer Lawrence. And Deborah Tate comes out and says, I'm not sure if Jennifer Lawrence is pretty enough to be Sharon Tate. So it's...
Okay.
So on the one hand, she's very sensitive about, I guess, the portrayal of her sister. But on the other hand, she's willing to, I guess, rank...
other
potential
women.
Actresses who might play her. Margot Robbie, beautiful enough. Jennifer Lawrence, not beautiful enough. But I do like what you're saying about the natural born killers angle. And also, we're talking about 69, 70, 71. So it's like right where sort of Tarantino's developed his influence, the sort of 60s style, the low budget grindhouse kind of aesthetic. So, I mean, he's been kind of circling that world for years, even though he's never stepped foot into that actual time period.
Yeah, no, I guess he technically hasn't really. He's been mostly talking about it by placing films in modern time that are very nostalgic or referential to those times. But yeah, he really hasn't gone
forward
there.
Or looking forward in those times. Yeah, because you have Hateful Eight and Django, which are both westerns, but they're very, you know, especially Hateful Eight, which is kind of like cowboy Reservoir Dogs in its way. So it's
not cowboy Ocean's 11.
I couldn't really detect an Ocean's 11 vibe in there. The other point you made about this still, you know, being, you know, fairly prescient. There's who am I looking at here? The members of the Manson family have been up for parole lately. They did approve Leslie Van Houten for parole, though Governor Jerry Brown put the kibosh on it. And then Patricia Krenwinkel was also up for parole again, and then she did not make parole. So Charlie Manson himself is still alive.
Yep.
And so, yeah.
And married, which is weird. Didn't he recently get married?
I would have to look that up. I'm not so immersed in the Manson world.
I feel like that was news maybe in the last like 5 or 6 years.
No, you're right. It might have been. I did find it more concerning that they were talking about letting Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel back out in the world. I mean, Patricia Krenwinkel did stab Abigail Folger 28 times. I did look that up because I wanted to just have the right context of this wasn't... Linda Kasabian, who was the lookout for on the night they went and killed Sharon Tate and four other people, including Abigail Folger. So they weren't like innocent lambs. They were there holding the knife. Mm-hmm. Another reason I think it's kind of an interesting time to explore it, and I mean, and I don't know how deep Tarantino will get into it, but, you know, there is kind of a cult, kind of a dangerous cult operating right now, and it's kind of around someone who does have the authority to have people killed, and it's currently the president of the United States, and this is probably like super controversial, but I do recognize if you watch TV news and you see some of the people come out and defend some of the things Donald Trump says and does, it just strikes me as very, very cultish.
Well, I mean, and you can even pull it back from that rather political statement and say that there are a lot of other cults.
Sure.
I mean, I'll call them cults, right? Like the Westboro Baptist Church.
Sure.
I don't remember the name of the group, but the people who went and occupied the wildlife facility or whatever.
Saying that
it was their land, whatever that group was. And even, you know, the rise of the KKK and other neo-Nazi groups.
Right.
Like there are a lot of opportunities for people to become radicalized.
And even you know, people like the Quiverfuls, who are represented by the Duggar family. I mean, that's almost cultish as well.
Yeah, sorry, so.
that was a wince.
Audio.
That was a full body wince.
Yeah. Sight gag on an audio show. Sorry.
Yeah, so, I mean, plus, you know, you're talking about the 60s, and there are elements in Manson's crimes of sexism because most of the followers were women. There's elements of racism because of Helter Skelter and wanting to start a race war. So, you know, all these sort of thematic tendrils are reaching from that time period into today. So it could be very interesting, but on the other hand, it could be, like you said, it could be natural born killers, but a real life story. And I have no idea what direction, because Brad Pitt was mentioned, and the part they were talking about was he was going to play Vincent Bogliosi, who was the prosecutor. So is it going to be like a Law and Order thing also?
Huh.
So it's kind of weird. Anyway.
Flashbacks? I don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But I would be interested. I mean, Quentin Tarantino, worth noting, did direct an episode of CSI.
He did.
So he's not. So this kind of procedural function is not far out of mind for him. So, I mean, we'll see. We do want to get to this one because I know you. This is up your alley. Kyle Smith of the National Review wrote a op-ed. If you like art, don't take the Bechdel test. And I think there's a bit of assumption that this is this thing everybody knows. But the Bechdel test, Alison Bechdel, who is a cartoonist and graphic novelist, 1985, came up with the three steps to decide if, you know, a movie does have good representation for women. It must have at least two women characters. They must talk to each other. And the topic of the conversation must not be about a man. I've heard a lot of people use the Bechdel test sort of colloquially, like, this is great because it passes the Bechdel test. I've never been of the opinion that it's sort of the end-all, be-all of feminism or feminist representation in film. But I do get the feeling that Kyle Smith had a piece of dynamite he wanted to set on fire by writing this.
Mm-hmm. So let's discuss the Bechdel test for a while. I know it has the word test in the title.
Yeah.
But it's not actually a test that, you know, things either pass or fail. And if they fail, they're put into a fiery pit for all time.
Right.
Right? It's
agreed. This is, agreed.
You know, we have to remember that where this came from was from a graphic novel, which was comedic in nature. Two women. It was a setup for a joke. The joke being, I haven't been able to see a movie in 6 years since Aliens. Right? That's the thing. It's the one woman saying to the other, I won't go see a movie unless it passes these three things, meaning it has the two named characters who speak to each other, not about the man. It's 1984, 1985. The last movie I was able to see was Alien.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's a setup for a joke.
Right.
This is not the be-all, end-all, like you say, of either art or feminism. Like, why? Well, I know why. But why must men feel like it's something that's going to tell them that they are wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Because there are a lot of great feminist things that don't pass the Bechdel test.
Sure.
So first, this guy needs to just stop caring. Like, honest to God, it was a joke, for one thing.
Yeah.
People have picked it up as that's kind of an interesting way to just quickly decide whether or not there's some representation in here.
Mm-hmm.
Representation, also not the be-all and end-all of art, right? We are going to talk about Sofia Coppola's film. I don't think we're probably maybe going to not talk about it so much, but there is a lot of controversy about her having erased the slave character from it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was just not the story she wanted to tell. She wanted to tell a different story. That doesn't make the story she told not art.
Right.
It just makes it the story she told rather than the other story.
Right. And almost every conversation in that movie, and we'll get to that, is about the man character. But
yes.
I think somebody actually proctored Beguile just to make sure it did pass, which I think exhibits a lot of effort on their part. But this is kind of a key thing. I first heard about it on the Slash Filmcast, and I think David Chen is kind of obsessed with it. It's just like, you can't measure something like Alien 3, which is in that franchise.
Yep.
But there's no other female character in the film because she lands on a planet that is a male prison. So how it's set up to fail. Using the test metaphor, I did read one article and somebody pointed out a favorite of mine, Pacific Rim. There's a character in it, Mako, who is a woman. She is an Asian person of Asian descent, but she is a strong, independent character who has her own narrative arc. She has a purpose to being in the film that is separate apart from whatever connection she has to the male characters. She is not the love interest at all, and she is treated as an equal throughout. But there's really no other female character in that film, or at least not that I can think of who's by name. It's, you know, everyone else is Idris Elba and Charlie Hannum and Charlie Day and Bern Gorman is in it, Ron Perlman. So, you know, there's really no one of the female persuasion she can interact with. But you can tell me that that isn't a great female character, just a great character, period.
Yeah, it's true. And I have that written down here because since I've, to be fair, I haven't actually seen Pacific Rim yet. I wanted to see it on the big screen and I missed it for a variety of reasons. And I just haven't bothered to see it at home on my little Netflix screen because it seems like it's probably going to lose something. So it hasn't made it to the top of my list. However, since I've heard about Mako Mori is her name, so in the Mako Mori test, I'm like, yes, actually this makes sense to me because that's all I want is a character to have their own agency and narrative story arc where they start in one place and end somewhere else and they have taken actions throughout it to get to the next place.
Right.
I mean, I often joke that my own life doesn't generally pass the Bechdel test, so I've never found it for me to be a good measure of whether or not the film is going to appeal to me or make me feel like I am represented somehow.
Right.
So, you know, that's the thing about art is that everybody gets to go to the thing that they like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't actually read the op-ed by this Kyle Smith. Is that his name?
Mm-hmm.
I read about it. I said, oh, okay, here's a person who somehow is personally offended and feels like, and I'm assuming he doesn't actually write or direct movies himself, so I don't know what his stake is in it. But for some reason, like a lot of other people who are of the more powerful class, thinks that by sharing the power, it means they're going to have less of it.
Yeah, and like I said, that when we started talking about this, it just seemed like one of these pieces that sometimes people write because they know they're going to get clicks and they know they're going to get hate for it. And hate translates into clicks, which also translates into people writing their own hot takes. And then it kind of goes on and on like this. And I found somebody who pointed out, speaking of the Bechdel test, they said two women discussing being bullied at work by a man would make for a feminist drama certainly preferable to a play in which two women briefly compare shoes but spend the rest of the time servicing the narrative arcs of the men.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a great example. It passes the Bechdel test, having two women talk about shoes versus something I wouldn't pass the Bechdel test, having two women talking about a man, but not in a romantic way about the man, but in terms of this is a man that is making our lives miserable because he's a bad boss or a bad friend or something. And where I think the proper context of the test is, if originally written as a joke, but if there is a way to sort of work it into the broader conversation, it's for on the part of, I think, writers and directors to say, sort of keep in the back of their minds. If we have something like, say, Kong Skull Island, where there's one female character in it, a photographer played by Brie Larson. And granted, it's a movie about military guys, and it was the 1970s. It takes place in the 70s, so there weren't a lot of men in the military. But still, you're talking about, thinking the way you would approach that script is have the Bechdel test in the back of your head. Okay, we have one female character. Is there a way to get in another female character? Is there a way we can have them have a conversation? Is there a way we can have them interact? While at the same time, making them full-blooded characters and full-fledged characters. And I think that's where this is useful. But to like sort of go, to have like some kind of, you know, meter with you, some kind of ruler as you go into a movie and, you know, holding it up to the screen as it's unfolding. Yeah, it doesn't do you any good. And that's where kind of Kyle Smith is kind of like, if you just read the headline, you go, yeah. But when you dig in deeper into the article, it's clearly just a screed about how feminists are making his life miserable, which is, I don't think, the point of the Bechdel test at all.
I do think it's important to remember, again, where it came from and that it was ultimately the setup for a joke, which is that this one woman hasn't been able to see a film since Alien. It's important to remember that Alien wasn't written with women in mind.
No.
And that is, in a way, why those women characters are so good. Because it was all just genderless, which of course means men. That's what neutral is. Neutral means man.
Yeah.
So they were genderless. They were all just, you know, named characters. And it wasn't until casting that they decided on Veronica Cartwright and Sigourney Weaver to fill in two of those roles. And what's interesting is when you do watch it, you do start to see that you can watch it in one way and look at the women characters and realize, yes, at no point do they ever particularly say something feminine or, you know, do anything feminine. But at the same time, because their mere presence is there, you do see different interactions, right?
Right.
The interactions between Veronica Cartwright and John Hurt, I often watch it and I think, I feel like, I mean, this is what, 6 or 7 people on a ship, a deep mining, like they spend all their time together, right?
Yeah.
And so Veronica Cartwright and John Hurt had a certain amount of chemistry. And even though they share very little screen time, it sort of looks like, you know what? I think maybe they cared for each other in a way beyond just we work together.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you look at Sigourney Weaver and Tom Skerritt too, there was a lot of sort of a chemistry between them as well.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, isn't written on the paper,
mm-hmm.
but you just see it in the way that they're interacting together, this sort of respect for each other. And, you know, it's...
There's tension there because she's the second in command, too. And, you know, there might be a bit of, like, rebuff because she's ambitious and maybe looking to get her own command on her own ship. And also because he's kind of more of a company man, which, of course, the company looms large in all the Alien movies.
Yeah.
And she's the one who's saying, like, no, we have procedures, because there's that whole bit when we're talking about aliens. But the whole bit where they're bringing John Hurt's character, Dallas, back after he's been face-hugged.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, we have procedures. We're not letting, like, foreign alien entity things, you know, no matter if our friend's life is at stake, at board, you know, we can't compromise the ship.
Yeah.
And that's actually, now that I'm talking about it, you know, that's actually the fairly emotionless, very pragmatic thing you would typically assign to the man. But in that situation, it was the woman saying, no, this is a bad, stupid idea. We're not doing it.
Yeah. And when Charlize Theron in Prometheus, I think, pretty much does a similar thing, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
You see it as she's the woman in charge who is being cold. And, like, it's not a good thing when she does it.
Right.
It does not come off as a good thing. It comes off as she has no humanity.
Yeah.
Right? And that character was written as a woman.
You're right. That is interesting.
Uh-huh. And this is why the Bechdel test, now I'm going to come back. This is why the Bechdel test is actually important, because it is just simply about awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Because people, you know, we're just looking at art, at entertainment, at life in general. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to not notice those subtle things that happen.
Absolutely.
That just become part of our DNA and have brought us to this place now.
Yeah.
So anything that can bring a little bit of awareness, just shed a little bit of light on it so that you ask the question, does this pass the Bechdel test? No, it doesn't. Does that mean it's a bad movie, or does that mean that these characters who are being played by women are not strong and independent and making their own decisions?
Right.
Maybe it doesn't.
Right.
But it makes you ask the question.
Yeah, and I think that's the right context. I think what we do need is a Bechdel test for Middle Eastern characters, because there was this controversy. It started earlier in the week with a Hollywood Reporter article that there was apparently some difficult, after testing 2,000 people, to find an Aladdin and a Jasmine for a live-action Aladdin movie. And then on Saturday at D23, which is the big Disney trade convention where they show all the Disney stuff, they announced, no, we have a young man named Mena Massad, and who's a Canadian, by the way, and a young lady named Naomi Scott, who you may recognize as the Pink Ranger from the Power Rangers movie, are going to play Aladdin and Jasmine. So problem solved, except there's now controversy because Naomi Scott is half English, half Indian. So apparently this is causing a bit of friction too, because a lot of people saying, well, you can't find someone who's Middle Eastern. But I think the real point of the conversation is, because in that Hollywood Reporter article, they're saying, well, the frontrunners are Dev Patel and Riz Ahmed, the two brown people in Hollywood.
Our token Southeast Asian men. Yep.
Exactly. Yep. And it speaks to that larger concern that I heard one person put it, the Hollywood Rolodex for certain minority actors is very small. That once you get past Riz Ahmed and Dev Patel, you're left.
SOL, as they say.
SOL, as they say. Well done.
Yeah, thank you. I am likely going to have some trouble with my language in this one, so I'll try to maintain my anger. But so I didn't hear the news that they have announced casting now. I only had the earlier sort of update that, oh my goodness, it's been so difficult for us to find a brown actor who can both sing and dance. My first response is, wouldn't it be amazing if there was a multi-billion dollar industry of films by brown actors who sing and dance?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, have they never watched a Bollywood film? There is a huge, huge industry of very capable actors who are action films, you know, action stars, romance stars, you know, family dramas, all of these things, and many of them both sing and dance.
Mm-hmm.
Did they go through that entire cadre of actors?
Who knows? But that was part of it. And there were like listicles that popped up. They're like, here are 10 Bollywood men who could easily play Aladdin, Hollywood, in case you can't find anyone. Which was, you know, why was this controversy drummed up in the first place if they're a few days away from announcing casting?
Yeah.
That is the real question. And you are right about the Bollywood angle. And there were a number of people did point that out, which is why it's interesting that they would cast Naomi Scott, who is half Indian, and you know, and then there are a lot of people making the fuss, well, she's only half Indian and it's not Middle Eastern, but you know, it's I think it's more to the point, you know, I don't think it's worth us, you know, attacking this young woman for taking a job. I think it's more to the point of the system that, you know, it's good on Disney for actually trying to reflect the culture that the story is set in. They're doing the same thing for Mulan. They're trying to find a young woman on the Chinese mainland who can play Mulan and not that live-action movie. But, yeah, it's – and in so much as you've got to start somewhere, it just proves that – the representation is pitiful in Hollywood, that they can't – that there isn't like 10 young men between the ages of 20 and 29 who could fill the boots or slippers of Aladdin, what have you.
Yeah. The other problem I have here is that, of course, as soon as we start talking about women or people of color, all of the choices about whether or not to give them the job are based on meritocracy, which it is not about that when we talk about hiring a white man. So how can we list the number of films where the white male lead couldn't sing? So either it was auto-tuned or they hired someone else to overdub it.
Right.
Or even like white women too, right? And I don't know if maybe the reason they were looking so hard is because their previous film, Beauty and the Beast, Emma Watson was in it. And there was a lot of talk about how poor her singing was. And so now they really wanted to nail, like, oh my gosh, we really have to make sure we have someone who's a good singer. But why didn't they have to worry that much before?
Right.
Because I'm sure they noticed very quickly that Emma Watson had a range of three notes. Right? And so what do we do? Oh, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's Emma Watson. We'll just auto-tune her. Well, why isn't it fine to hire any of these other actors that they had who presumably would have filled the role really well because they were very good actors?
Yeah.
And say, oh, but he only has a range of a handful of notes, but it's okay because we can just fix it like we did for all the white people in all the other things we cast them in, right? How come meritocracy is suddenly so important?
Yeah.
And meritocracy is just a false construct anyways, but...
No, it's a point, and I think you have all these different things colliding together. You have, you know, you wanting the authenticity. It's like, yeah, maybe Emma Watson isn't the world's best singer, but yeah, you're seeing Emma Watson sing. Not everyone's a great singer, and I think if that was the point, they would have just dubbed her anyway. But it's funny that, you know, they're trying to get people who can be the triple, maybe even quadruple threat in the case of, you know, the person who would play Aladdin, because just remembering from the movie, you know, you're talking about someone who's a street thief and very athletic, and so you can sort of picture that action sequence of him being chased around by the palace guard, especially with Guy Ritchie directing. That's going to be a trip. But yeah, it is kind of frustrating that it wasn't just they were chasing representation, it's that they have to chase the perfect representation as well, that you have to be all things to all people if you're going to play Aladdin as a Middle Easterner or Jasmine as a Middle Easterner.
How difficult must it be to have to carry your entire race with you?
Oh, for sure.
I can't even imagine.
So I mean, that's absolutely right. Anyway, we'll have to leave that there and call a break, because then we have a very interesting movie to dissect, and I think that's going to be very interesting, especially given our previous discussion. But so for our musical break, we're going to play The Sound Carriers. They did a piece of music called So Beguiled, and it's from their 2014 album, Entropicalia. I did not get a chance to look up what Entropicalia means, but this is the song. It is called, once again, So Beguiled. And this show that you're listening to is End Credits, and this is CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Is he dead?
No, not yet. Quick, we need to move him to the porch.
And that was a scene from The Beguiled, and it is the new film by Sofia Coppola. It stars Nicole Kidman, Colin Farrell, Elle Fanning, and Kirsten Dunst. And I do want to maybe set this up, because we didn't talk about this beforehand, but I think it's going to be impossible to really talk about this without going into spoilers.
Yeah.
So just be aware that the direction could go that way. So if you're super sensitive about spoilers, maybe turn your radio right now and come back once you've seen the movie. We will try our best to avoid them, but our best is sometimes not good enough when we're talking about movies like this. So just be warned. I do want to hear your thoughts. It turned out we were at the same screening.
Yeah.
But I am kind of interested, because I did find the movie interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't begrudge anyone for having mixed feelings about it. It's may end up being one of those movies either you really get into or you that really turns you off. I would say I might have to see it again, but I did find it interesting enough. I found it an interesting take on the material. I haven't seen the original Beguiling, the 71 starring Clint Eastwood, but from what I've read about it, it's very, let's say, of the era. It sounds very of the era, and so this I think was probably, again, having not seen the original, probably a bit of a more compelling take, but I do want to hear your thoughts.
Okay, so I do want to talk about the technical aspect of this film after my first hot take on what I thought of this film, because I do think that that's where this film really, really shines, and I have a lot of thoughts about the more technical side of filmmaking. But just from a general point of view, the trailer for this movie, like I heard about it. I knew Sofia Coppola. I do enjoy her films. I like The Virgin Suicides. I like Lost in Translation. I know they're going to be smallish, character-driven, visually lush. I kind of, you know, I sort of know that going in. I also had heard some of the controversy around the erasure of the one black character.
Mm-hmm.
I've also not seen the original or read the book, and I really didn't know what the film was about until I saw a trailer for it just this week, actually, after I had already agreed to do this. I was like, yeah, I'll go see the new Sofia Coppola. I mean, I haven't, it's, yeah. And then I saw the trailer, and I think the trailer is not cut for me. I don't know who the trailer is cut for, but I saw the trailer and I thought, oh my God, I am going to hate this movie. As I joke that my life does not pass the Bechdel test, the idea of a confinement of a bunch of women being very womanly just and fighting over a man, I was like, oh my God. What did I agree to do? Okay. All right. I'm going to go see this. So I did see it, and it wasn't as awful as the trailer led me to believe it was going to be.
Yeah,
the trailer's terrible. It is still a confinement of women acting womanly and fighting over a man. That is actually what this movie is about.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't as horrible as the trailer led me to believe. But it does sort of leave me at this place where I don't dislike the movie. I didn't dislike the story, but I find it interesting that people are saying, oh, the feminist-tinged film by Sofia Coppola, and sort of putting this weight on it. And what I understand from this movie, if I distill it down to one sentence, is that men are evil, women are stupid and will always fall for their tricks, and the only way to survive is to have sex with them or to kill them. This is what this movie taught me, which is not remotely a feminist message. There's nothing, as far as I'm concerned, in this film that makes women powerful or the savior or anything. This is a bunch of women who fell for a man.
Yeah. I was not... I think that aspect of it, that it's a feminist movie, has been overblown, oversold. It's not in that regard. I think I probably liked it a bit more than you did, because I think I think the gallows humor and the dark humor and it probably spoke to me a bit more. I did like, first of all, that it was kind of this isolated thing, that they were all alone in this, other than a couple of times you see where soldiers kind of pass by. And it takes place during the Civil War. I don't think we stated that, but so it's like 1964. The Confederates are... 1864. The Confederates are, you know, about 9 months away from defeat. It's Virginia, which I think that was one of the changes she made. It was in Georgia before, but they moved it to Virginia, which is a bit more interesting because it's a bit more closer to the front. So anytime you heard in that clip there, you heard the cannons going off in the distance.
Amazing. I love that.
Yeah, it almost makes it sound like a soundtrack in that regard, like somebody's like just gently hitting the bass drum. And, but yeah, you sometimes see the smoke from the cannon fire over the trees. But I mean, other than that, it's very isolated to this one house. So it's very foreboding in that way. And you definitely feel their isolation, which... I think kind of sells, you know, when the little girl Amy finds him and brings him back. I didn't just read that as a fact. It's like, oh, there's a man in our midst. Well, heavenly day. which there definitely is that.
Yep.
But it is also this fact that here is a foreign element. Here's somebody from the outside world. He might as well be a Martian, you know, being here, someone in a blue uniform who we've been told is our enemy. And one of the girls even says, like, oh, the Union soldiers are rapists, all of them. And so I found that part of it very compelling. And in so much as I see your point that, you know, men are evil.
Yeah.
That's kind of the message. It's like, yeah, you welcome them in and then you know, you make them a nice dinner and you heal their leg and then, you know, they go all evil.
And then they seem to think that they're entitled to something when you don't give it to them. Yeah, I mean, this was very... I mean, I guess you can say it is feminist-tinged in that she basically took all of the things that men's right activists, so people, the men who are most on the fringes talking about all of the things that they deserve and things that are taken from them, she really... made that into one person and also made the things that women take from them very, very real. Like, right. So she basically took sort of a large group of people and injected all of it into one man.
Yes.
And gave him very real consequences, mm-hmm. You know, very real, very real things that were taken from him.
Yeah, and that's what I found interesting. It was that he's not played as sort of, Colin Farrell plays it very kind of middle of the road, I think, where I'm not sure how much of it where he's playing the women, you know, he kind of has like a scene with each of them, you know, Kirsten Dunst, who I'll get to in a second, but you know, there's Elle Fanning, who's, you know, I think she in real life Elle Fanning's like 17, 18, and Nicole Kidman is, of course, you know, the elder
the matron.
Of the group, the matron, yeah. And so, you know, so he has, you know, these kind of scenes with all of them and sort of playing to them, and he's talking to the Nicole Kidman character. Martha is like, oh, you're very bold, ma'am, you know, and I admire that. And she's like, well, I don't care what you admire. And so he's sort of crafting himself to appeal to each one of them in their
yes.
own way. And but there's still at the same time a question. Is he ingratiating himself because he's someone who ran away from the battlefield and he's someone who got involved in a war he had no kind of full idea of its savagery and is grateful for this mm-hmm. oasis? Or is he playing them because he is a very shrewd manipulator? And he sees a way to not only get out of the battlefield, but he sees a way to just hang around this place where he's just surrounded by women and he can be the man. And, of course, as soon as his leg heals enough that he can sort of walk on it, what does he do? He gets out there and does man stuff, and he's
yeah.
cutting down trees, and he's doing the gardening, mm-hmm. and he's showing these women how awesomely manly he is.
Yes.
So
yeah.
there's so many ways you can, well, the two ways anyway,
yeah.
there's very many levels to it.
And I do think that it's actually both.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he did sort of leave the battlefield sort of thinking, this was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I've made a mistake. I mean, and you know, he's not even an American.
Yeah, he's like an
yeah.
Irish mercenary. Yeah.
Yeah, so he's just fresh off the boat, as he said, is the
yeah.
exact line he used. So he realizes that he made a mistake,
mm-hmm.
and he lucked out,
yes.
I think, in that he found this place where there are these women, and he knew exactly how to play them.
Yeah.
I mean, every time he shared a scene with a different character, I was like, this guy read the game and is working it. He is working it so hard. And that's the part to me that's just like, ugh, this makes me feel gross. He makes me feel so gross, and it makes me feel even more gross that all of the women fell for it. And he
mm-hmm.
played every one of them differently, like you said, right? There's the one who actually saved him, where he became like her best friend, and we're just cool,
yeah,
and we're
buddies.
Yeah, he
says to her, like, you're my best friend in the world.
Yeah, and then the one who's older, and he's talking, you know, being vulnerable
yes.
with her.
Right.
Because she's clearly an independent woman, so he knows that trying to be the man with her isn't going to work. There's the one that he's, you know, he can tell that she's very quiet,
mm-hmm.
but has something there. So he's, like, he's just playing every single one of them, and they all fall for it, and it makes me feel so gross. Like, I have no other words than I had to go home and just take a shower. I felt so gross.
But is it supposed to make you feel gross?
Probably.
That's and also we have the benefit of seeing him with each of the women,
yeah.
And so we see him change his tune,
yeah.
with all of them, and so we know, and we, of course, after one of them leaves, he kind of leans back and he's like, nailed it,
yep.
and so we kind of have these insights into him. So I get that. I totally get that. It does feel mm-hmm. gross that
yeah.
to see them being played like that. But again, I think that's the point. Kirsten Dunst, I found interesting in this movie, and this is kind of more of your whitewashing, unfortunately, because I think in the original book, the character of I think her name is Edna
mm-hmm.
or Edwina. She was a mixed race person.
Mm, okay.
So, but Kirsten Dunst obviously is not, but Kirsten Dunst is very interesting in this because she's, I mean, obviously older now,
mm-hmm.
and she's not, you know, old by that stretch of the imagination,
yeah.
but she the way she plays it herself and is very distinctive. She has very character. I don't think she's like really made up at all. So,
yeah.
So you can kind of see that independence, that world weariness, you said, because someone who was Kirsten Dunst's age in this time period would, of course, be...
A spinster.
Yeah.
Yep. So, never, she's got no hope left. She's never going to be married.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, you kind of see that, too. And and I think a lot of that grossness does come from the period as well.
Yeah.
But Kirsten Dunst, I found fascinating to watch because I think we all remember her as, you know, as a young woman, you know, Interview with the Vampire, Jumanji, and then...
Virgin Suicides.
Yeah. Spider-Man.
Totally different character, yeah. Right? From Virgin Suicides to this, where in Virgin Suicides, she was sex personified.
Yep.
Right? And in this, she is just very much not, like... You know, she's almost the furthest from it of all of those characters.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and it's really interesting. I mean, I really enjoy Kirsten Dunst. And frankly, the performances in this film were top-notch at every level. Like, all of them were just so good.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the thing. Like, I don't dislike this movie. I just sort of am concerned about how people are sort of framing it.
Yeah.
I think this movie is beautiful. Like every other Sofia Coppola film, I said, you know, it's visually stunning. Their story told through visual medium. You know, we notice the changing time by this one beautiful shot, which happens over and over and over again at golden hour as the one girl is looking out with a telescope. And so that's how we're measuring the chronology of how much time is passing, right? Like what a tiny thing to do that, you know, you could sort of leave out, but it also... You know, it's also at golden hour, which is just beautiful.
And hard to film.
Yeah. And then on top of that, like, speaking of filming, so the lighting in this film was amazing. At every moment, I felt like I was in a dark room only lit by either the sunshine or the candles. Like, it was so well done. Dark, kind of foreboding. Like, everything about this technically was amazing.
Yeah.
And even right down, and again, I talk about how, you know, measuring the chronology, and she's made this scene to do that. Well, even just the aspect ratio, and I'm not sure if you noticed, but I noticed right away the aspect ratio of this film, which is the uber nerdiest thing for me to talk about. That's the size of the frame on the screen.
Yeah.
It's super boxy.
Yeah.
It was like watching an old Western on your parents' TV in the 80s. Everything was pan and scan, right?
Right.
Like, it's so boxy. And so the second I noticed that, I noticed and thought, I'm going to look that up because this is a really bizarre aspect ratio to be filming this in. Why would you do that in this day and age?
Yeah.
And so I did look it up, and Sofia Coppola made a very conscious decision to make it very boxy, not widen out the screen like many other films, especially with such a beautiful landscape.
Yeah.
You would think you would just widen that out, right? She boxed it up because she wanted people to feel boxed in.
Yeah.
And I'm sure some of that, what, you know, the lighting and the squareness of it and the fact that they'd never sort of leave this place, all of those things help you feel as confined as every other person in that film.
And it adds to the chamber play aspect of it, too. Somebody called it it's a comedy of manners, which is a very old-fashioned sort of thing where, you know, it's a play about, you know, how, I guess my American cousin might be the most famous example. You know, you have this one bourgeois figure who comes in and ruins the austerity of a given place. And there is a very much an aspect to that, too. So it's kind of very old-fashioned in that respect. And yeah, the mood of it is great. There was music in the film, but I don't remember it at all. It seemed to be like one of these movies where it's kind of creeping at the side.
Mm-hmm.
But sound design, of course, is so important to it because, of course, they're in the middle of nowhere. You know, there's no major road that goes by or anything like that. And there's only the two scenes where there are people who come in from the outside. And the most prevalent sound you hear is that cannon fire off in the distance where it's... And that could mean it could be like your heartbeat. It could be, you know, a metronome. It could be the passage of time because as soon as the sun comes up, that's when you start going boom, 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 and you start launching on the enemy. And then, of course, it kind of gets further away as the movie moves on. Because there's a scene in it where one of the Confederate soldiers say they're retreating from the area, so the cannon fire gets further and further away, and of course that's when things end up changing inside the house as well, and so there's a very Danger Within quality of that where after what happens, and the Colin Farrell character sort of changes.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of makes it all the more scarier. And that's when when you really feel that isolation.
Yeah,
that they're all alone, and they do have to sort this out.
Yeah.
On their own.
And I will say that is sort of one place where I do have a little bit of trouble with the film, because I love that it was a really like tight kind of 80-90 minute run.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I think a lot of films are falling prey to, oh, we can just keep going. People will sit and watch a 2-2.5 hour long film, and so they pack it full of stuff that's totally unnecessary.
Yeah.
It's, you know, that could be a whole other movie, that sort of stuff. Whereas this was very like nice and tight. But I do think there were places towards the end in the climax as things are unfurling,
mm-hmm,
that were very quick. It was sort of like, okay, but how did he get there?
Mm-hmm.
How did he get this thing? Where, you know, where was he that he was able to see this other person go run for the gate? Like, where did these things, you know,
yeah,
it was too quickly paced, and it seemed like there were a lot of things that were just like, whatever, just deal with it. Just go with it.
Yeah, that one scene, he had like a very kind of psycho killer from a horror movie aspect,
yeah,
where you turn around and he's there.
Yeah.
It's that is true. But I think the fact that it is kind of a tight 90 minutes,
mm-hmm,
kind of does kind of override that a bit. I was able to forgive that a little.
Yeah.
I just want to stress too that how well acted it is. I think Colin Farrell was really good. One of the girls in it, Inouye Rice, who people may recognize from The Nice Guys. She was Ryan Gosling's daughter in The Nice Guys, and she's so good in that.
Mm-hmm.
And she plays Jane in this, who's kind of like the least sort of corruptible, shall we say?
Yeah, she did not fall prey to his wily, manly ways.
Yeah.
So
but you know, she's really good in that. The little girl who plays Amy, whose name I wrote down to. Yes, Una Lawrence.
Lawrence. Okay.
Yeah, and I liked her a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Nicole Kidman, I liked a lot, and especially in that one scene where they figure out what to do with Colin Farrell, and it's the one girl I don't think has any other lines until that moment. So under the theory of it's always the quiet ones,
yeah.
But then when she says it, and this look appears on Nicole Kidman's face, it's like, oh snap, and she plays it really really well.
Mm-hmm.
I and Elle Fanning, I think she probably gets. It's just kind of the most corruptible one. I think she kind of,
or is she the one with the most agency?
Interesting. You could be right. But she does get her moment too. Like there's a scene where like they're in the garden, and, mm-hmm, and she's kind of just like, she has no desire to be gardening at all, and she's just kind of like ramming the hoe in. And
she was the 1864 goth girl.
That's
with her
right.
With her perfectly disheveled couple of strands of hair at the front. It was just like exactly perfect every time. I'm like, I can remember doing that to my hair so that it accidentally looked like my hair just fell out of its perfectly neat.
I'm too busy to do my hair, so I'm making my hair look like I'm too busy to do my hair.
Yeah.
That kind of feeling. And she's building up quite an interesting repertoire too.
Mm-hmm.
And if anyone wants to see like something that'll really, you know, kind of, I don't know, freak you out or play around with your mind, The Neon Demon, the Nicholas Rending Refn, also kind of a horror movie but kind of not. That's an interesting movie to watch and talk about,
mm-hmm,
and she's the star of that too.
Yeah.
So she might be an interesting young actress to watch going forward.
Yeah.
So there you have it, folks. That was The Beguiling, or The Beguiled.
The Beguiled.
I know. I want to say Beguiling for some reason. It's Beguiled. I think we're sort of interested by it. It's one of these movies you're gonna have a lot of fun talking about with the people you go see it with, but it is not the feminist savior of the year.
Yeah.
Anyway, that is it for this edition of End Credits. We hope you liked it, and if you did like it, you can listen to it later on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can find us on social media at End Credits Radio on Facebook and End Credits Radio on Twitter. Candace.
Yes.
How can people find more of your thoughts and opinions?
Well, you can find me on the internet at every medium at Sin48, that's CINN48. And you can also listen to the Village Podcast, which I do on behalf of the Bookshelf, Downtown Guelph.
And there's just a new episode of that, isn't there?
There is, yeah. It just came out earlier last week.
Well, there you go. You can connect with me at Nerd Bastards. I write about movies, TV shows, and other nerdy stuff there every day. And this is a big nerdy week because San Diego Comic-Con is coming up. There's going to be a lot of news coming out of that. I'll be back on CFRU later today, Thursday at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Source's Guelph. And that is with my partner there, Scotty Hertz. So stay tuned for that. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we will be back here next Thursday morning at 10 a.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then.